So thank you all for coming. And we're going to have an interesting 2 days in discussing the Vimalakirti Sutra. I don't think we'll get through the entire sutra. In fact, we may get through just even a beginning part of it. But because it's so rich and there's so many really good, tasty portions in the sutra to explore. So we'll do what we can, and the point is to practice whatever it is that we learn. Before we start the actual talk, let's take a minute and cultivate our motivation. So since we're going to be looking at a Mahayana sutra, a sutra that speaks of the Bodhisattva practices, let's generate a Mahayana motivation, the bodhicitta motivation that the Bodhisattvas also have. And so this motivation looks way beyond this life. It looks way beyond ourselves. It's a very expansive motivation that thinks of the welfare of each and every sentient being and encompasses the long-term happiness and well-being of each living being. And this bodhicitta motivation not only is filled with love and compassion, but with it we take the responsibility to be of great benefit to sentient beings, to lead them on the path to full awakening. And to do that, we have to accomplish full awakening ourselves. So we generate that aspiration for Buddhahood so that we can benefit all living beings most effectively. So let's make that our motivation tonight. Let's make that the reason that we're here sharing the Buddha's teachings this evening. So, first, just a little bit about the Vimalakirti Sutra in general. So we don't really know historically when it appeared in India. It seems like it predates the Lotus Sutra, and it comes after the Prajnaparamita Sutra. So maybe it appeared and began to be widespread around the 3rd century. We really don't know. But it was one of the first 3 Mahayana sutras translated into Chinese. And it was retranslated into Chinese again and again and again because people just loved this sutra. Okay, it became very, very popular in China and still is very popular. In fact, this temple is named after it. Okay, so, you know, what was it that made this sutra so popular in China? It could be Because the main character, Vimalakirti, is a lay bodhisattva, so, you know, that made him very appealing because, you know, Confucianism was quite popular and widespread in China, and according to the Confucian mentality, you should get married and have a family. So in Buddhism, when they talked about ordaining and becoming a monastic, some people didn't like that so much. It didn't correspond with Confucian values. But the idea of a lay bodhisattva, such as Vimalakirti, was very much in line with that. So that may be one reason why it became so popular in China. Another reason may be that one strong theme of the sutra is duality versus non-duality. Okay, the duality of the world versus the non-duality of directly perceiving the ultimate nature. And so Chinese culture, you know, people were very, very interested in that theme. The Vimalakirti Sutra is also a literary work, and it has, it's a drama, yeah? It's really interesting because it reads like a play. And in fact, I have some friends in America who acted out certain parts, certain sections of the sutra in costume and reciting the lines of the sutra. It was quite interesting, they told me. Yeah. They acted out the scene where the goddess changes Shariputra from a man into a woman. So it was very interesting when they were doing the skit and changing costumes and making that happen. So, yeah, it's a dramatic work. It also is very humorous. You know, we often think of the Dharma as being very serious and the sutras as being very serious, but this sutra has a lot of humor in it. And as you read certain portions of it, you kind of have to chuckle because it's like the Buddha is, he's kind of like poking at some of his disciples and saying, hey, look guys, you know, have you really understood what I'm saying in a deep way? So we'll come to some of those sections, I'll point them out. It may also have been popular because it was this drama, it had humor in it, and it was also, in some sections, really very shocking. You know, it's not just kind of like a nice drama that goes along and, you know, everybody lives happily ever after. But you have scenes in here where the high-level bodhisattvas, they're dumbstruck, they don't know what to say. You have scenes where the arhats are like, I don't know what's going on here, you know? So in some places in this sutra, it's very surprising, you know, how he sets up, how the characters are set up, how they relate to each other. It really makes you think. Okay, so maybe I'll give just a very brief synopsis of the sutra and then we'll start looking at some sections of it. So in chapter one, the Buddha is teaching in a garden that was donated by a courtesan. And all these beings arrive, you know, some of them are bodhisattvas, some of them are devas, some are human beings, some are arhats. They all arrive with their own parasols. And the Buddha takes all these parasols and makes it into one huge parasol which encompasses the whole world. So there's some meaning behind it. It's like we all come to the Dharma with our own parasol. We all come thinking, me, I, my, mine. Yeah, what's good for me, what I like. And then the Buddha takes all of that and it, you know, transforming it into a huge parasol that encompasses the world. He's saying, actually, we need to come together as one body of sentient beings, bound together by the bodhisattva motivation and the dedication to the welfare of all living beings. And in that way, we need to purify our entire world and purify all of our minds. In other words, we're not just doing our Buddhist practice as our own trip. Yeah. It's not like, okay, I'm going to the temple because I feel good when I go to the temple. No. Okay. And it's not, I'm going to the temple because there's this really good-looking guy there and I hope I'll see him. And it's not, I'm going to the temple because the food is good. And believe me, I had dinner here tonight, the food is great. But that's not the reason why we're coming to the Dharma. Okay? We're coming for something else. We're coming because we are all interrelated. Yeah? We need to help each other. It's not every person for their own. Yeah, we need to come together and help each other. And that's so important in life, and, you know, to not only to have a happy life now, but also to create good karma for future lives, and certainly to attain full awakening. Because you never hear of a selfish Buddha. Okay. You never hear of a Buddha who says, oh, I think I'll go teach somewhere because they'll give me lunch afterwards. Yeah. That's not the reason why. Yeah. We have to come together for a reason that is all-encompassing for all of us, to protect all of us from samsara. Then in chapter 2, in the great city of Visali, there was a rich man named Vimalakirti who was very proficient in wisdom and a master of skillful means. Okay, so skillful means is another theme of this sutra, and we'll speak about it hopefully tonight. So Vimalakirti was a layperson. But he had attained the fortitude of the non-arising of dharmas. And so this is a very high realization. For those of you who know the Mahayana paths and stages, it's the eighth bhumi of the Bodhisattva path. So it's quite a high realization. He lives at home in a very nice house, but his wish is to benefit other living beings. So he uses all of his wealth to relieve the poor. He has faultless observation of the precepts and actually reproaches people who don't keep good ethical conduct. And although he wears the clothes of a lay person, he observes all the Vinaya rules that the Buddha set up for the monastics. Okay. So he lived at home with all this wealth, with a family. So he was celibate, but he also had a wife and kids. Yeah, go figure that one out. Yeah, this is showing something special about Vimalakirti. Yeah, so it could be that, you know, maybe he had sexual relationships with his wife, but he still had a very pure mind. Or it could be, because he was an eighth ground bodhisattva, that he was manifesting this whole house and a wife and children. Yeah, they could be manifestations of his wisdom as well. In any case, he had zero attachment to his house and the householder life. Yeah. So a little bit different from us, wouldn't you say? Yeah. So he wasn't attached to his HDB flat. Yeah. And he wasn't trying to, you know, get on the list to buy a new flat, you know, and wait a few years. But rather he was just completely satisfied, you know, with his flat, with what he had. He didn't want a new car. Can you believe it? He was happy with the car he had. Sometimes he even rode the MRT. Okay? So he ate and drank like everybody else. Yeah. But what he really enjoyed was meditation. Okay? So he went to work. Yeah. And very un-Singaporean, he didn't complain about his boss. Because his boss was the Buddha, and he don't complain about the Buddha. Okay. So his work was to benefit all these sentient beings, and he loved his work. Yeah? He loved his work. His boss did not ask him to lie and cheat. Yeah? So he had correct livelihood, and he enjoyed his work. Okay, and so the sutra in chapter 2 shows Vimalakirti. He gets sick. Okay, now he actually probably isn't sick. You know, he doesn't have SARS. He doesn't have, you know, pneumonia or something like that. But he manifests getting sick. So that the people in the town who revered him would come and visit him. And when they came to visit him, then he would have the opportunity to teach them Dharma. Okay. So you might say that he was dishonest in pretending to be sick, you know, like, I want to call in sick so I don't have to go to work. You know, it wasn't like that. It was because he knew that this way people would come and he would be able to teach them. Okay. So then in the third chapter, you have the Buddha trying to get some of his Shravaka disciples, his disciples who were intent on arhatship, not on full Buddhahood, to go to visit Vimalakirti. And in the fourth chapter, the Buddha encourages the bodhisattvas to go. But neither the hearers nor the bodhisattvas really wanted to go to visit Vimalakirti, because every time they did, they were completely dumbstruck. And they didn't know what to say, because Vimalakirti would ask them questions, you know, about the Dharma, and here are these arhats and bodhisattvas going, what's this guy talking about, you know? So they were a little bit embarrassed. They didn't want to go. Okay. So, for example, I'll save that for later. Okay. Well, no, I'll tell you. Just to give you, so Subhuti, who was a bodhisattva, okay, he went to call on Vimalakirti and say, how are you? We heard you were sick, you know. And Vimalakirti offered him some food and said, Subhuti, take this food if you understand the equality of all things. If, without abandoning greed, hatred, and confusion, you avoid association with them. If you can refrain from destroying the idea of self, yet follow the path. Take this food If without seeing the Buddha, hearing the Dharma, or serving the Sangha, you take up religious life under non-Buddhist teachers and follow the ways they prescribe. Take this food if you fall into the three lower realms, if you entertain all passions, if you have hostile feelings towards all living beings, if you despise the Buddha, if you do not rely on the Sangha, if you never enter final liberation. What do you think of that? You know, here's somebody who's a holy being who's saying, I'll give you food if you do all these unethical non-dharma actions, but without having greed, hatred, and ignorance. What would you say? Yeah. So Subhuti, you know, when he left the house and he reported to the Buddha that he was dumbfounded, not knowing what sort of words these were, how to answer them. Yeah. And he tries to leave Vimalakirti's house. And Vimalakirti stops him and says, the nature of all things is like illusion. You should not fear them. All words have that nature, and thus the wise are not attached to words. Language does not really exist. The nature of all things is liberation. You know, Subhuti had just gone there to say, how are you feeling, Vimalakirti? Do you need some aspirin? And, you know, look what he gets, and he doesn't know what to say. So all these other hearers, disciples, and bodhisattvas go, same thing happens to them. So it's an interesting way to start this drama where you have all these highly realized beings who don't know how to answer questions that the lay bodhisattva Vimalakirti asks them. Okay? So then in the fifth chapter, Manjushri Bodhisattva comes and he discusses with Vimalakirti about how a bodhisattva should counsel another bodhisattva who is sick. And in this, Manjushri is leading everybody else to visit Vimalakirti, and he's also bringing forth the essence of the Mahayana path. Teaching that ensues there. In the sixth chapter, we have Shariputra and Mahakasyapa, two of the most famous of the Buddha's arhat disciples, who are very sadly left behind by the profundity of the Mahayana Dharma that Vimalakirti is teaching. Okay? And so this is a little bit embarrassing for them. And then there's a very, here's where some humor comes in, okay? So when Shariputra, you know, came into Vimalakirti's house to inquire how he was, he looked around and there were no seats. And so he starts to think, where are all these bodhisattvas and arahats going to sit down? And Vimalakirti reads his mind and says to Shariputra, did you come here for the Dharma or are you just looking for a place to sit? Somebody said that to Shariputra, can you imagine? This is the Buddha, Shariputra is the Buddha's foremost disciple in wisdom. He didn't know what to say. Okay. In the seventh chapter, this chapter is really funny. Okay, and it's really profound. It's very good. Okay, so here's Shariputra, and he's attempting to express his realization of nirvana by being silent. But there's a goddess who appears in the house and challenges Shariputra, saying that his silence is unskillful. Okay? That silence by its nature is not more profound or more expressive than words. Poor Shariputra, you know? I mean, he's the Buddha's foremost disciple. First, Mallakirti says, did you just come here to find a place to sit? And then this goddess, you know, insults them and says, you know, you're just being silent because you don't know anything, not because you've really realized nirvana. Okay. And then the scene goes on, and with the goddess and Shariputra having a discussion. And then Shariputra asks the goddess how long she's been in the house. And she responds by asking him how long he's been liberated. And Shariputra again was silent and didn't answer. So the goddess says, with your great wisdom, Shariputra, why do you remain silent? And Shariputra says, liberation cannot be spoken of in words. The goddess says, words, writing are all marks of liberation. Why? Liberation is not internal, not external, and not in between. Do you understand what he meant? Take some pondering. Shariputra said, doesn't liberation mean getting rid of greed, anger, and delusion? And the goddess said, when speaking to arrogant people, the Buddha skillfully taught this. When addressing those without such arrogance, the Buddha said that the very nature of greed, anger, and delusion is liberation itself. Shariputra says, excellent. What have you seized on that you have said such eloquence? And the goddess says, I have seized on nothing, seen into nothing, and hence speak with eloquence. So you see this whole drama that's unfolding, yeah? One person is talking from the ultimate viewpoint, the other person's talking from the conventional viewpoint. And so that's why the conversation seems disjointed. Okay? The goddess says, I have seized on nothing, I've seen nothing, but I speak with eloquence. In other words, you know, she hasn't seen anything that is inherently existing. She hasn't seen anything with duality. And that's, she's speaking from the ultimate viewpoint, and that's what enables her to be so eloquent. Then, so this whole thing's going on with Shariputra, who's a monk, and this goddess, you know. So then, after a while, this is a great scene, yeah. Shariputra says, why don't you change out of this female body? Okay? Because we all know that in the cultures where Buddhists exist, actually, in the cultures all over the world, women are seen as less than men. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Yeah. If you don't believe it, listen to what Donald Trump says. Yeah, he puts women down right, left, and center, and this is the 21st century. Okay, so let alone, you know. Yeah. So Shariputra's kind of, you know, like goddess, you're intelligent. Why don't you dump this female body and be a man? Yeah, because if you're a man, you'll get enlightened really quick. You'll be sharp. You'll be intelligent. You won't have this female body that you have to worry about Donald Trump, you know, touching. You know, why don't you become a man? So, you know, he says, why don't you change out of this female body? So the goddess says, I can't find it. What is there to change? All things are just the same without fixed form. In other words, all of our bodies, male and female, are exactly the same in that their ultimate nature is that they have no inherent nature. We are not inherently men or women. Okay? We are merely designated men and women based on the layout of some molecules and atoms of our body. Aside from that, there's no men and there's no women that exist inherently. Okay? So then what happens here? Then the goddess, after she says that to Shariputra, then she changes Shariputra's body into a female body. Okay. So here's Shariputra, you know, this very pure monk, and all of a sudden, I'm a woman, you know? He kind of freaks out. And the goddess says to him, Shariputra, who is not a woman, appears in a woman's body. The same is true of all women. So all women are not inherently existent women. They appear in a woman's body. And all men are not inherently existent men. They appear in a man's body. So the goddess says, like Shariputra's female body, all things do not exist, yet do not non-exist. So all things don't inherently exist, but they're not totally non-existent. Yeah. She eventually changes him back into a man. Yeah. And then Shariputra goes, whoa, what an experience that was. Then in chapter 8, Vimalakirti teaches that bodhisattvas follow the way that is not the way, and then explains what he means. Okay? So, this gets very interesting. Okay, I'm gonna skip this part. Then chapter 9, Manjushri explains non-duality, followed by Vimalakirti's silent demonstration of non-duality. So earlier in the sutra, we had Shariputra being silent because he didn't know the answer, and he was trying to look like he attained nirvana. And here, that's compared to Manjushri, who explains non-duality. And then Vimalakirti, who realizes non-duality, remains silent. Okay. And then Vimalakirti asks all these bodhisattvas to explain how a bodhisattva enters the gate of non-duality. And each bodhisattva, in turn, gives a teaching on this. And then after that, Manjushri turns to question Vimalakirti about what is non-duality. And Vimalakirti remains silent. Okay. Not because he doesn't know, not because he's faking it, but because he knows that the ultimate realization goes beyond words and concepts. And at that point, Manjushri says, excellent, excellent. Not a word, not a syllable. This truly is to enter the gate of non-duality. So he approves of what Vimalakirti says. Okay. Chapter 10, there's some more humor. Because Vimalakirti sends for some takeout food from a distant Pure Land. I guess they have Chinese takeout or maybe, you know, Domino's pizza, something like that, in a distant Pure Land. So Vimala Kirti sends for it. But none of the others can go pick it up. Okay. And then Shariputra, because remember, he's this arhat, very strict precept. He thinks, oh no, it's almost noon, and as monks, we can't eat after midday. What are all these bodhisattvas going to eat? Vimalakirti ordered this takeout food from a Pure Land that's across town, even across the universe, and nobody can go pick it up. What are we going to eat? So Vimalakirti then, again reading Shariputra's mind, says, Shariputra, why are you distracted by thoughts of eating when you are listening to the Dharma? Yeah. He really squashed Shariputra there. Okay. Then in chapter 11, okay, so Vimalakirti then, you know, because at the beginning of the sutra, the Buddha was teaching in this very beautiful garden, and Vimalakirti was teaching in his house, and then everybody went to Vimalakirti's house. Now in chapter 11, Vimalakirti transports everybody back to the Buddha's garden, okay? And there the Buddha gives a teaching that explains how all the Buddhas of diverse universes teach in many, many different skillful ways according to the mentality of the disciples. Okay, then in chapter 12, the Buddha asks Vimalakirti some questions. And Shariputra asked where Vimalakirti was born. And Vimalakirti talks about birthlessness and says, there's no birth, there's no arising, there's no production. Okay. So another thing, Shariputra's talking from the conventional point of view. You know, were you born at Singapore General Hospital? You know, where were you born? And Vimalakirti answers from the ultimate viewpoint, I was not born. I didn't arise. Yeah. Which means that he arose not dependent, not independently, not inherently, but dependently. Okay? And at that point, Shariputra, he has a change of heart, and he's inspired to make a bodhisattva-like prayer that the Buddha enable all beings to be born in a pure land and for all beings to have powers to help others just like Vimalakirti does. So this is a big change in Shariputra. And then there's more teachings here about liberating skillful means and non-duality and so forth. Okay, and then chapter 13 and 14 talks about how to preserve this sutra. And so first the Buddha talks about the giving of the Dharma being the highest form of generosity. And he charges Maitreya Bodhisattva with promulgating this sutra and many similar sutras in the future. And he charges Ananda with memorizing it. Okay, and then at the end, Shariputra, again, he's really changed by the end of the sutra. He promises that anyone who preserves this sutra will you know, create vast merit. And so the gods promise to protect it. And, yeah, and then there's a lot of instructions about how to preserve the sutra by teaching it, by copying it out, and so forth. Okay? So that's kind of the layout of the sutra, just a very brief overview. There's lots of drama in it, but it's not an action movie. Okay. Yeah. Yesterday I'm on the plane. I flew in from Taiwan, so I don't watch movies in the plane. But the person ahead of me and to the right in my line of vision, was watching the new Tarzan movie. You know. So this is not an action film like the Tarzan movie, okay? The Tarzan movie is just full of anger and lust. That's it. Yeah. So if you want to have a nice session of having your negative emotions generated in your mind, go see that movie. You'll create a lot of negative karma. Yeah. If you want to try and overcome attachment and anger in your mind, then stay at home and read the Vimalakirti Sutra. Okay? So, then I want to start reading. So it's amazing, in all these Mahayana sutras, the Buddha speaks to huge crowds of people without a microphone. Yeah? I mean, nowadays, you know, not just one microphone, two microphones. Okay. But the Buddha was able to speak and everybody heard him perfectly. So there were 8,000 bhikshus in this garden where the sutra takes place, at the opening scene of the sutra takes place. 32,000 bodhisattvas, yeah, and then all sorts of other gods and demigods and related disciples, everybody's there, okay? So it's like Santosa. Everybody went there, okay? They were having a special thing at Santosa. Everybody went. Okay, so the sutra starts about talking about the bodhisattvas who were present. And in a way, this whole description, the beginning of the sutra, it's very much like other Mahayana sutras, where it gives the names of the many bodhisattvas and it talks about their characteristics. But today, when I was reading this, it really struck me, you know? And it's like, this opening passage here is really talking about what it's like to be a bodhisattva. Have you ever wondered what that's like? We all say, oh, I want to be a bodhisattva. I want to be like Kuan Yin. I want to be like Samantabhadra. I want to be like Manjushri. But what does that mean? Yeah, what is our image of being a bodhisattva? Does it mean that you just sit there frozen, sitting on your elephant, sitting on your lion, you know, or you're frozen holding a vase, catatonic, you know. Is that what bodhisattvahood is like? Yeah. Or, you know, do you think bodhisattva, you know, you just stand there and people give you, oh, hey, bodhisattva got a good tonight, I got a whole watermelon. Yeah, usually it's just a few apples or oranges. Yeah, but very good. Oh, I think, what else is up there? Oh, pineapple. Bodhisattva struck it rich tonight. Pineapple, watermelon, yeah, Chinese pears, and some flowers. Okay, Look here. If you're upgraded from being a bodhisattva to a Buddha, look what you get. Many pineapples, another watermelon, oranges, okay, pears, and lots of pears. Look, not just a couple. Yeah. And tons of apples. Wow, that's good. And more flowers. Can't eat the flowers, though. But, you know, what's our idea of being a bodhisattva? Yeah, you're just frozen there, and then people give you fruit that they take the next day and eat themselves. You know, do you really want to sign up for that job? You know, it's like somebody promising you a paycheck and then they take it back. Okay. So these opening verses talk about what it's like to be a bodhisattva. This is really cool. Okay, so I'll read it to you and comment on some of it. So the bodhisattvas present have all accomplished the original practices of great wisdom. Okay, so they had great wisdom. So there's actually three kinds of wisdom. The wisdom that knows the conventional truth, how things function in the world, specifically how karma and its effects, that law of causality functions in the world, that's conventional wisdom. Ultimate wisdom understands the deeper nature of things, how things actually exist. And the third kind of wisdom knows how to benefit sentient beings. Three kinds of wisdom that are really useful to have, that, and you need all three to become a Buddha. Okay, one or two won't do. You have to have all three. Now imagine the wisdom that knows how to benefit sentient beings. Because we all have compassion, don't we? You know, it's in there somewhere. Sometimes it's covered up. But we can find it, it's there. And we want to help others, but sometimes we don't know what to do. You ever been in that situation? Yeah, maybe a family member or a good friend is really having a problem. You want to help them, but you don't know what to do. What do I say? Okay. So this wisdom that knows how to benefit sentient beings, knows what to say, and when to say it, and how to say it. And the bodhisattva doesn't expect that when they say something to somebody, that the person's going to instantly go, you know, you're right, and I'm going to follow your advice. Because very often, when we try and help people, if they don't want to be helped, if they're stuck in their own mindset, yeah, we can talk until we're blue in the face, and so can the bodhisattvas, and that other person's not going to change. So in order to really benefit sentient beings, you have to have a lot of internal strength so that you know exactly what to say when, but you don't expect anything from the other person. And you know that it could take a long while until that person from their side wants to change. But from your side, you don't give up on them. You keep the door open, you do what you can, but you don't get worried, you don't get frustrated, you don't get angry. You just realize that this, you're trying to help a sentient being who is overwhelmed by ignorance, and it's going to take a while. Okay? You had that situation in your life? Yeah? So we need to know how to handle those situations. Okay, what else about these bodhisattvas? They were established in the numinous charisma of the Buddhas. They maintained the correct dharma for the protection of the dharma city, the dharma realm. Okay, what does it mean to maintain the correct dharma? It means that we understand the Buddha's teachings correctly. That we don't just read something and then put our own interpretation on it, but we actually hear the teachings from a qualified teacher, we think about them, we discuss them with others, we meditate on them, to make sure we have the correct understanding. Yeah. If we don't have the correct understanding, it can be very dangerous, not only for ourselves, because there's no way for us to get realizations without the correct understanding. But if we have the wrong understanding and then explain it to other people, then we can really lead other people astray. And I say this because nowadays, yeah, we have different people who are saying all sorts of things that they say is the Buddha's teachings that you can't find in any sutra. Okay. There's one movement that's very popular saying, well, the Buddha didn't teach about rebirth. Actually, in the sutras, it's very clear that the Buddha taught rebirth. Yeah. But some people, they don't understand rebirth well, or they don't like it. So they just kind of edit it out and say, well, the Buddha didn't really teach it. So this kind of thing is dangerous. Yeah, we have to make sure we really understand the Dharma well. Okay, so these bodhisattvas did. Okay. They made their names heard throughout the 10 directions through their ability at the lion's roar. Okay, what the lion's roar often refers to the Buddha. You know, because the Buddha's like a lion in the jungle. Who has the loudest voice? The lion. Yeah. And when the lion roars, everybody stops to listen. So too, when the Buddha speaks the Dharma, yeah, everybody stops to listen. Nobody's voice can roar the truth louder than the Buddha's voice. Okay, so these bodhisattvas were very close to full awakening because they had some ability at this lion's roar. They befriended and pacified people without being requested. So these bodhisattvas are friendly people. When they go into a social setting, they're outgoing, they talk to people, they're friendly, they care about people. And so it is in our Buddhist temples and our Buddhist centers. It's very important when we go there that we reach out to the other people who are there. Okay? Sometimes I hear people say, oh, at these Buddhist centers, people only go to meditate and then they leave. They only go to listen to teachings and then they leave. Yeah. Actually, it shouldn't be like that. When we go to centers, to temples, we should reach out to the other people who are there. Maybe it's their first time coming to that place. So we need to help them find a place to sit, show them where the prayers are in the prayer book, explain the etiquette to them. Yeah, we need to talk to them and say hi. You know, what brought you to the Dharma? What do you want to learn here? How can I help you? Okay, so it's quite important for us to be like these bodhisattvas and be friendly and outgoing to people. Okay, and they did all of this without being requested. So I think that's kind of cool, you know? When you go into a social setting, to go in and think, oh, who here at this social setting may not know anybody? Who can I go to talk to and help that person feel at ease because they're coming into a new environment and they don't know anybody? Kind of like when you get a new employee at work, do you go to that employee, the new person at work, and introduce yourself and say hi, ask them out, you know, for to have tea or something, befriend them because they're a little nervous, they're in a new workplace. Okay, so really reaching out to others in this way. Also, when we meet strangers on the street, yeah, if people ask us directions, to help them find where they're going. In some places, in America, my country, we'll give people directions, but we won't take them to where they're going. Okay, we'll say, you go up to this stoplight, make a left, go down two blocks, make a right, go three blocks, make another right, go four blocks, make a left. We'll give them instructions, but we won't lead them there. There are some countries in the world where if you ask someone how to get somewhere, they'll take you there. Yeah. And if you're a stranger in that place, boy, you really appreciate it. Then there's other countries that I've been to where you ask directions and people don't know how to get there, but they tell you something anyway. Don't do that. Okay. So the bodhisattvas, let's see, what else? They befriended and pacified people without being requested. They exalted the three jewels of the Buddha's Dharma and Sangha and were thus able to keep them from being cut off. So they really had very deep faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So what does it mean to have deep faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Does it mean you just go to the temple, get a jaw stick and go like this? Yeah? And then put your jaw stick in the incense and go, oh, namo mitofo, namo mitofo, namo mitofo. Oh, namo mitofo, that's enough. Okay? Is that what it means to have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Yeah? Buddhism is a very special philosophy. It's not based on blind faith. Yeah? It's based on asking questions, on investigation, examination. Okay? The Buddhism requires that we use reasoning, that we put on our thinking caps, and we really think about the teachings and try and understand them. Does this make sense? When I practice it, does it work? Okay. And so in Buddhism, asking questions is said to be one of the causes of gaining wisdom. Okay? Keeping our mouths shut because we're afraid to ask questions is a sign of ignorance. Okay. And also in Buddhism, it's not blind faith. Yeah, Buddha did not encourage blind faith at all. Yeah, he really encouraged understanding. So that means that we have to learn and we have to think about things. But that's the real beauty of the Buddha's teachings. Because when we learn and when we think, then our mind gets transformed. If we don't learn and we don't think, we may say all sorts of things, but our mind is not transformed. And so the spiritual path does us no good whatsoever. There's some religions that discourage asking questions. I remember when I was a teenager, I studied different religions, and I would go to a priest or a pastor or someone and ask them questions. And the basic answer I got was, that's a mystery. Yep, it sure is a mystery. Because the message was, don't ask a question because we don't know the answer. Just be quiet and believe. And I could not be quiet and just believe. Because the things I was hearing didn't make any sense. And I can't force myself to believe something that doesn't make sense. So that's what I really appreciated about the Buddha's teachings, what I really respected, yeah, was that the very first teachings I went to, the teacher said, think about what we say, don't just believe it blindly. And I said, oh, what a relief. That's wonderful. Because if the monks had gotten up there and said, we have the truth, the Buddha said, blah, 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 just believe it, I would have said, bye-bye. Not for me, thank you. Yeah. So Buddhism is quite special this way. But it means that we have responsibility to learn and think. Okay. So these bodhisattvas subjugated the vengeful Maras and controlled those of heterodox paths. So the vengeful Maras, in Buddhist sutras, Mara is portrayed, he's anthropomorphized, you know, as to be like a demon or some wicked person. Actually, what Mara is our own ignorance, anger, and attachment. Yeah. But it's making them, it's anthropomorphizing ignorance, anger, and attachment to be like, you know, this kind of wicked being, Mara, you know. So these bodhisattvas subdued the Maras. They subdued their own ignorance, anger, and attachment. Okay? And they also controlled those of heterodox paths, those beings who had wrong views. So the bodhisattvas had great compassion for people with wrong views. Yeah? And they tried to show them the correct path, but they did that very skillfully. They didn't go to somebody with wrong views and say, you have the wrong view and you're going to hell. Yeah? From a Buddhist viewpoint, that is not a polite way to speak to another sentient being, nor is it beneficial. Okay. So the Buddha helped those with wrong views, but he helped them in a very respectful way. have some interesting karma. Sometimes I have the karma to be seated next to evangelicals on a long flight. Okay, this brings, it's very interesting. So one flight, I was flying from, I think, Seattle to Madison, Wisconsin, something like that. So I'm sitting next to this man and we start talking. And he starts telling me how I'm going to hell. You know, nice conversation, isn't it? Hi, what religion are you? I'm Buddhist. Oh, you're going to hell. You know, and then he said, and then to boot, he said, well, I'm telling you this out of compassion so that you could change how you think. And I said to him, you know, I said, God is supposed to be compassionate. You say God is compassionate. I keep good ethical conduct, or at least I try to. I don't lie, I don't steal. I try and not speak harshly to others. I try to be kind and forgive others. Is a compassionate God going to send me to hell just because I don't praise him? That's what I said to the man. Okay. He didn't answer that question. He kept on a little bit, trying to convince me. And I said to him plainly, I said, I feel annoyed because I need respect. I told you what I believed. I respect your choice in religion. I think you need to respect my choice in religion. I said it very directly to him. I said it in that tone of voice. It was a nice tone of voice. But it was very firm. And I said, I need you to respect my choice. And then the conversation kind of tapered off. At the end of the flight, when we were getting out to leave, he said, maybe I was a little bit too strong when I talked to you. So I think maybe something had gone in. Because, you know, I said, I appreciate your compassion, but that's not my way of showing compassion. Because by your definition of compassion, you know, if you're going to try and teach me so I don't go to hell, then I should try and teach you Buddhism so that you don't go to hell. Said we need to respect each other's different choices of religion. Anyway, that was a long story to explain how these bodhisattvas controlled those of heterodox paths. Okay. So the bodhisattvas were entirely purified and had forever transcended the afflictions. They maintain their minds always in peace and unhindered emancipation. They were unfailing in their mindfulness, their concentration, their memorization of the Dharma, and in their eloquence. Yeah. These are quite some living beings, these bodhisattvas. Okay. They were replete in generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, and wisdom. What are those six? I just listed six terms. What are they? They're the six paramitas. This is bodhisattva practices. Okay. These bodhisattvas were replete in the power of skillful means. They had attained the fortitude of the non-arising of dharmas and the non-attainment of all things. So they had actually reached the state of arhatship, although they were bodhisattvas. They understood well the characteristics of the dharma and understood the capacities, the dispositions, the temperaments of sentient beings. Okay, it goes on and on here, quite long. Okay, I'll just read the rest and then we'll have some Q&A, but I just want to get through this section. Okay, they had attained the fearlessness in sheltering the great congregations, cultivated their minds with merit and wisdom. Merit and wisdom are the two important practices for bodhisattvas. They were paramount in the adornment of their bodies with 32 signs and 80 signs and marks of a Buddha. They had dispensed with worldly adornments, were known above and beyond even Mount Everest or Mount Meru. They were firmly resolute in faith, like a vajra or a diamond. They illuminated the Dharma jewel everywhere and rained down the sweet dew of the Dharma. They were paramount in the subtleties of the host of spoken words. Okay, so they knew how to speak correctly, how to explain things so other people understood. They profoundly entered into conditioned generation, into dependent arising, to eliminate false views. So they explain dependent arising, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama says is the Buddha's slogan. Okay? To eliminate false views. They were without any residual influence of the two extremes of being and not being. So they didn't fall to the extremes of asserting inherent existence or total non-existence. They preached the Dharma without fear, like the lion's roar, preached with reverberations like thunder, were without measure and beyond measurement, were like ocean captains who had collected the many Dharma jewels, comprehended the profound and wondrous meanings of the Dharmas, understood well the past tendencies and current mental dispositions of sentient beings. This is very important. If you want to benefit sentient beings, you have to understand their way of thinking. Yeah. And you have to be really skillful in, you know, understanding that different people see things in different ways. They have different capacities, different tendencies, different things that are going to make sense to them. So you need to understand these very well so that you can really communicate to other beings. They approach the unparalleled autonomous wisdom of the Buddha with the 10 powers, the 4 fearlessnesses, and the 18 exclusive attributes of the Buddha. They had closed all the doors of the lower realms, but were reborn in the 6 realms in order to manifest their bodies there to benefit others. So these bodhisattvas had overcome the ignorance and the polluted karma that causes rebirth in samsara. And yet, out of compassion for sentient beings, they manifested in our polluted realms in order to help us. And they still do that. They were great medicine kings who were good at healing the various illnesses. They provided medicine according to the illness and caused it to be taken, were accomplished in all the immeasurable merits, had ornamented and purified all the immeasurable Buddha lands, unfailingly used what they saw and heard for the benefit of others and never squandered away their endeavors. They were thus entirely replete in all merit. Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice to be a bodhisattva? Yeah? When you think, wow, I could be free of all ignorance, anger, and attachment forever. Which means that the whole world could insult me and my feelings wouldn't be hurt. It would mean that the whole world could betray my trust and I wouldn't get upset. It would mean that all the beautiful things in the world could appear before me and my mind wouldn't go crazy with greed and desire. Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice to never get jealous again? Jealousy is painful. It's a miserable motivation. When we're these high-level bodhisattvas, we never get jealous again. We've gone beyond jealousy. Wow. Wouldn't that be nice? We've gone beyond arrogance. We've gone beyond laziness. So when you think about these qualities of the bodhisattvas, then you think, you know, they cultivated those qualities, so I can too. Yeah, if they did it, I can do it too. Because all the Buddhas, all the bodhisattvas were once ignorant beings like us. But they practiced and they developed those qualities. So we can practice and develop those same qualities. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah? Wouldn't that be better than getting all the promotions in the world? Wouldn't that be better than making a ton of money and winning the lottery? Yeah? I think it'd be much better than that. And we have that potential. We can do that. That Buddha nature, that Buddha potential is part of who we are and it can never be taken away from us. Okay, so we will pause here and there's time for a few questions if you have questions or comments.
Thank you very much for your Robo teaching. So if you have any questions, you may raise your hand and we'll pass the microphone to you. Any questions? Any other? Yeah. Or alternatively, you can write your question on the paper so that you can pass it to the volunteers.
This is your time to ask questions. Don't be shy.
Raising
the
microphone. Thanks for your questions.
Good question. What is meant by inherent existence? Inherent existence means independent existence. It means, first of all, inherent existence does not exist. But our problem is we think it does. So what that means is when we look at the bell, yeah, we think that this thing isn't just called a bell. We think there is something in it that really is a bell. Okay? When we look at people, we think that there's a real person somewhere inside their body. Actually, there isn't. This is all a fabrication of our mind. The reason, yeah, that this fabrication and grasping at this fabrication causes us problems and is the root of samsara is that we make everything very concrete. you know, figuratively. So if I'm a real person, concrete, me, independent of all factors, everything else, then, of course, I'm going to get very attached to my own happiness. And then I'll get very attached to everything that seems to bring me happiness, and I'll push everybody else away who gets in the, who obstructs my happiness. And I'll get upset and angry and destroy the people who bring me unhappiness. And so I create a lot of negative karma that then makes me get reborn in an unfortunate rebirth. Okay. So inherent existence does not exist. The root of samsara, of cyclic existence, is our ignorant mind that grasps inherent existence, that things really do exist independently with their own nature as self-enclosed entities. But they don't exist that way at all. They exist dependently. Okay? So it takes some time to understand what this means, and it takes some time to be able to identify what this grasping at inherent existence looks like in our own mind. It takes time, it's not easy. Okay? But we keep at it. There's a lot of questions here. What do we have? Okay, so somebody's saying, I am struggling with lust and temptation. Now, I feel sexually out of control. What can I do? What can I do to heal this? Okay. One thing to do is to really guard the senses. Okay. In other words, be careful what you look at. Be careful what your mind pays attention to. Because when we let our eyes when we let our eyes roam, when we let our fingers roam, yeah, then we see different objects, and then defilement arises in our mind. Okay? So be careful. Don't just let your eyes look at all the young, good-looking people. Don't spend your time looking at their bodies, assessing their bodies. Okay? Try, and when you're walking down the street, pay attention to the sidewalk. Okay? Pay attention to where you're walking, first of all, so you don't trip. Second of all, so you don't step on any living beings on the sidewalk. And then third, you won't be looking around, there's that really good-looking person. Yeah. Another method is to think about what the inside of that person's body looks like. Yeah? When we look at somebody, we have sexual attachment for them, but that's only because we're looking at the outside of their body. Yeah? Mentally, open up their body. What's there? A skeleton? Some muscles? Lungs? What's so beautiful about their body? Yeah. What are you lusting after? Maybe their esophagus? Yeah. Or their spleen. Your spleen is beautiful. Beyond control, you know? Yeah. Maybe their liver, or their tendons, or their intestines. What is it that is so beautiful about that person's body? The inside is not. You say, well, the outside of their body is so good. Look at their skin. So then you take all that skin and you put it out mentally. I'm not saying mentally, you imagine there's skin just piled as a heap on the table. What do you think then? Is that so beautiful? Your eyes are like diamonds. Your teeth are like pearls. So then mentally, you put two eyeballs out. And you take the teeth and you line them up one by one. Is that what you're attracted to? We all laugh, but this meditation works if you do it. Guaranteed to work if you do it. Okay. So don't laugh, but use the meditation. I feel and... the question is, how do I learn how to love and care for other living beings? Beautiful question, you know? Just asking that question shows that you care about yourself and you care about other living beings. One way I think that is very helpful to learn how to care about others is to think of the kindness that we've received from other living beings. That everything we have, everything we know, comes due to the efforts of other living beings. If you really spend a lot of time thinking about this, then every time you look around, you see kindness. And when we see kindness, of course we want to repay the kindness. Okay? So it means looking at these lights and thinking about the people at the public utilities board. Looking at the lights and thinking about the electricians and how hard they work to put these lights in. Or thinking about the lights and thinking about the people who work at the factories that manufacture light bulbs and LEDs and so on. It means thinking that we're sitting comfortably in an aircon room. And who installed the aircon? And who fixes the aircon when it breaks up? And how many people, out of the goodness of their heart, donated the money to the center in order to buy aircon so that people they didn't even know, like us, could be comfortable while listening to a Dharma teaching? When we look around, everything comes due to the efforts and kindness of other living beings. Yeah. This is an incredible meditation to do. If you do this regularly for like at least 15 minutes a day, your whole attitude towards others will change. Because you will see kindness everywhere you go. Because there is kindness everywhere we go. Okay. So, we have to stop tonight here. There's more questions which I can take up tomorrow night. Or if you have questions that you didn't get to ask, you can write them down and leave them on the table, and then maybe tomorrow night I can get to them. Okay? Okay, so now let's sit quietly for a minute and digest the teaching, letting the teaching sink into our mind. So think about something that you heard this evening so that you can recall it later and use it in your practice, and use it in your life. Just a very short time we'll contemplate this. us rejoice at all the merit, the good karma that we created this evening as individuals and as a group. And then let's dedicate all of our merit. You can even imagine it as like a light in the center of your chest, and you send it out to each and every living being. And imagine that merit that you're multiplying and radiating out to all the sentient beings. Think that it touches them and it brings them peace in their own heart. It opens their mind to the Buddha's teachings. It pacifies their ignorance, anger, and attachment, and brings love and compassion and wisdom into the minds of each and every living being. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi man, not yet born arising, grow. May that born have no decline, but increase for. So tomorrow morning you have a homework assignment. When you wake up in the morning, think today as much as possible, I'm not going to harm anybody. Today as much as possible, I want to be kind to others. And today I will keep the bodhicitta, that precious aspiration for full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. I will keep that bodhicitta in my heart and do all actions motivated by that altruistic intention. So just generate that motivation when you first wake up in the morning, and then see how it changes your day. Okay? And then I'll see you tomorrow evening.